Welcome, members and guests, to the April 24th program of the City Club of Eugene, How the Common Core Helps Achieve Our Goals for Public Education. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marlene Nesri, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Pacific University, Dr. Gail Leslie and Dr. Sandy Ibarra of Hearing Associates, and KVRM. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and also for archiving the podcasts on their site. We're pleased to welcome our newest member, Charles Dalton. And before we get to today's program, President-elect James Baldock will update the results of our recent City Club study group vote on the upcoming vehicle registration measure.
Hello, I'm James Baldock, President-elect, and I was head of the study group. At the May 24th City Club meeting here, today, I'm proud to announce that our study group members came back and are going to be telling us the results of this, of their ballot measure. The way we started this was we had a study group. We investigated the Lane County's legal options, the state of its roads, the county's finances, and proposed alternatives to the ballot measure. And the question was whether City Club should endorse or oppose the Lane County's $35 per year fee on automobiles that's coming out on the ballots. The study group studied all the options exhaustively. We asked our City Club members to endorse our position, which was that the City Club should support the measure. 2 weeks of online voting was available. One in-person ballot measure was available at last week's meeting here. We've tallied up all of the votes, and 78% of our members said that the City Club of Eugene should endorse Lane County's proposed ballot measure 2231. Thank you.
Thank you, James. Today's program, How the Common Core Helps Achieve Our Goals in Public Education, is coordinated by Mary Layton. Our speakers are Dev Sinha and Matt Coleman. Dev Sinha is a professor of mathematics at the University of Oregon with degrees from MIT and Stanford. His scholarship in algebraic topology is internationally recognized and has been supported by the National Science Foundation. He's also been deeply involved with the challenges facing K-12 mathematics teachers and has a daughter in 4J schools. Matt Coleman is the executive director and chief academic officer of EPIC, the Education Policy Improvement Center. He earned both his undergraduate and doctoral degrees from the University of Oregon and his master's from Lewis and Clark College. He has worked as an educational assistant, teacher, middle and high school principal, and as a district-level administrator. Coleman has 4 children in 4J schools. Program coordinator Mary Layton, a recently retired school administrator, will ask the first question. Please join me in welcoming today's presenters.
Got it? Good. Okay. So I made some slides, and those will be available for the City Club. You can post on your site. So wanted to basically answer with some depth, what is the Common Core? So the first thing is it's a set of learning goals, things that we want students to be able to do. It's not a curriculum. It's not a test. It's not an accountability system or anything like that. It's a vision of what we want students to do. It informs all those things. It also informs instruction, teacher professional learning, etc. What makes it different from what we did before is that states got together to work on this, and they were able to draw over 60 experts from around the country. No single state would have been able to do that. They were able to take the time to really consult the research, to really study what other states had done, to look internationally as well, and really take the time to write something, a coherent story of K-12 mathematics is what ultimately emerges. Okay, so that all sounds from, you know, looking at the Common Core website, but what is it really? Okay. What it really means is in mathematics, we want students to understand and be able to apply what they know. Understand and apply. Understand and apply. So for example, in second grade, if you think about you're learning your ones, tens, and hundreds, and you could give kids an activity like, okay, 2 hundreds, 5 tens, 3 ones makes blank. Okay? And let's pause and think, what kind of understanding does that demand? Well, some kids may understand. Some kids may just realize that those three numbers, 2, 5, 3, if you take them and write them on the line, you know, they get a check and they go on. Okay? You change it a little bit. How about 17 tens and 4 hundreds? What does that make? That's actually an interesting and kind of demanding little question. Okay? You want to, so how do they do that? Do they multiply 17 times 10 plus 400? No. The reasoning that we want them to be able to do is take 10 of those 17 tens, make 100. That, along with your 400s, that makes 500. And then those remaining 7 tens is 70. So that's 570. And what you can see, and I'll share a link, is even in Bethel School District, for example, you see classrooms of kids who are using things like little chips, hundreds chips, tens chips, ones chips. They might be physical. They might draw them. They put them into places. And they can do that reasoning even fairly early on using those chips. They'll take those 10 chips. They'll exchange them for 100. They'll put that 100 in the right place. They'll get 570, okay? And so, and then the story of the mathematics, this is what happens when you, for example, add, let's do a smaller example. If you add 35 and 27, really you get 50-12, right? 35 plus 50 plus 27 is 50-12. But we know you carry, okay, and it's really about regrouping those 12 ones, taking 10 of them. In a fourth grade classroom I was visiting recently, actually the kids started to say, because we were working with this kind of visual, take this over there, like, oh, let's send them to jail. Let's send them to tens jail, or let's send them to hundreds jail. Anyways, this is the process of what's going on when we add, and the Common Core does similar things for fractions, okay? Because you could say, all right, well, there's calculators, right? Well, what happens when you're supposed to be dividing 3 divided by a half, and you type in your calculator, 3 divided by 1 divided by 2? You get the right answer? No, no. So, you know, why should it be 3 divided by 0.5? Why should it be do the 1 half first or something like that, okay? If we just tell them, well, that's the way it is, there's two things about that. First, we know their knowledge is fragile. They show up down the road, and for example, historically over the last few years, kids who go to Lane Community College, so this isn't sort of, this isn't about sort of STEM so much, although that has its implications. Kids at Lane Community College, if they take a math placement exam, 75% have to retake K-12 math. 3 and 4 have to retake some K-12 math. They have to pay tuition. They have to spend that time. They don't all succeed. This is a barrier to becoming a nurse, a water technician, all sorts of living wage, sustainable career jobs. We are effectively shutting out because we have, and I really want to mean we, because I don't care about assigning blame, we collectively have not been teaching math well enough. Okay? So that's what the Common Core is about. It sets out this vision. Let me give you a little feel for it yourself. So what does it mean to, for example, think about applications a little bit? I'll give you a fun one. So as was said in the introduction, I'm a University of Oregon professor. You may have heard we've got this football team. And after every time they score, I'll still go through it. After every time they score, you know, if they just put up their 21st point, the duck will do 21 push-ups. So here's a little Common Core task. I know it's lunch, but I'll give you a little math to do. Suppose the Ducks score 70 points. Let's imagine this kind of September throwaway game.
Against Michigan State.
Even better. Okay. How many push-ups did the Duck do? All right. Talk with your neighbors a little bit. We should have handed out pencil and paper, but talk about this problem for a minute or two. Can you say how many push-ups the Duck did? All right. And normally in a class or something, I'd be walking around, et cetera, but I know we... I mean, I love to do math. I could spend all day doing math. That's why I do what I do. But we'll have to cut you guys a little short. Sorry. So is there an answer? Yes? No? Ooh, even better. Teachers love it when you have a little yes and no. Oh, God, I really want to get into it, but let me... no, really, I could spend the rest of the time. We could do this. We could have a good half hour of fun. But so the answer is actually no. It really depends on, is it, you know, touchdown after touchdown after touchdown, or are there field goals? When are the field goals? Then there's good follow-up questions like, okay, can you give a reasonable upper and lower estimate for it? Okay, can you think about the largest possible? Actually, that's and is that conceivable? And largest conceivable possible? Or yeah, so it's kind of fun to think about. Notice some of the features here. Actually, you had to sort of think about, do I have all the information I need? Okay, and maybe if I referred to a specific game, which is actually a good thing to do, you could say, ah, wait, you don't know have everything you need. How can we find it? Okay, this is easy on the internet. But that's also a thing. We want people to use what they know, and that means questioning, do I have enough information? Do I have too much information? Where can I find the information? Okay, how can I see the relevance of my calculation? How can I make some reasonable assumptions? Okay? At the end of the day, there's some lovely algebra, too. If you think about the 7 plus 14 plus 21, etc., that's what in math we call an arithmetic sequence, and you can tell stories of Gauss, who at 8 years old sort of figured out how to do these things. But so there's some really rich math, too, but also notice that application piece that's really important and something we want to do. Okay? The other, so the Common Core, and we can, I'm happy to answer any questions that I can about its development, but it was really sort of looking seriously, more closely at what students need to do and trying to serve that. The other consequence when the answer becomes students need to be able to use and apply and understand what they do, is that that engages some serious equity concerns. Because if you think about it, think about your high school algebra class. Think about sitting in there with like 30, simplify this, da-da-da-da-da. Why do we have to do this? Well, because one day in college you'll need to. Well, what if you're the first person in your family to go to college? What if nobody in your family went to college, right? Is school for you? If it's just these exercises? Well, if you get good at this, then one day you'll see. All right, and folks in this room probably know, yeah, how much did that really help me anyway? Okay? So it's kind of been about some hoops. It's part of what math has been. Math has been, in part, these hoops. Now, it's not, I love algebra. I think a lot of, you know, algebra skill is really needed, especially for your engineers, et cetera. Algebraic thinking is even more important, okay? And that's the kind of thing we really need to promote. Let's go back to that calculator example, that 3 divided by a half. How can we promote the kind of understanding that would help a nurse if, like, she got an order and realized 3 divided by a half was there, but then she saw 1.5? How could that click? And there's actually a 5th grade standard, I want to say, or I think it's 6th grade, no, 5th, that if you divide by a number smaller than 1, it should be bigger. But how can you see that? Well, let's make another analogy. So this will be harder for folks on radio, but let's just... picture, let's first start with whole numbers. Let's picture a 10-mile race and have it 2-mile legs, so 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. That's kind of a visual reason that 10 divided by 2 is 5, because it took 5 of those 2s in that sort of 10-mile relay race. Now let's think of a 3-mile relay race, and each leg is a half. So a half, 1, a half, 2, a half, 3. That was 6 halves make 3. That's why 3 divided by a half is 6, okay? So these are the kinds of things we want students to have access to. We want them to ask them to do things they understand. We want things also worthy of their attention, worthy of their thought, okay? And we just haven't been doing it. So some of the things that have been happening, just so you know, first of all, I can say that because we've been working together and can freely share, there are now a wealth of freely available materials that teachers all over the country can use that are better than anything that was available 3 years ago. So take your best classroom materials. Let me make that 5 years ago. Take your best classroom materials for 5 years ago. Free materials are better than those today. Okay? This makes a difference. I work with a lot of rural districts around here, folks who haven't had an adoption in 10, 15 years. They can now download and print. Teachers can try things. In fact, one did. So there was a teacher who was in a very rural district, very poor, in Lane County here. She came to some training that my colleague Tricia Bevins and I offered for free. She also went to some training. We're more content experts, as it were. She also went to some training up in Portland State with a well-known math educator, Nicole Riggleman, up there, who's a fantastic classroom expert. Based on what she learned, she's like, I want to try some of these, but my curriculum doesn't support me, and I don't want to write this myself, but we let her know you could download and print this, and she was able to. In her school, on these tests, which I guess we will talk a little bit about, historically, on the Old Oaks test, her pass rates were about 55%, plus or minus 10. It's not so good. Okay, we have better here in 4J, but again, and I'll agree with people who say it's a lot, you're measuring a lot of socioeconomic, yes. So 55% plus or minus 10 pass. After 1 year, she had a 90% pass rate. And more importantly, or equally importantly, whatever, what I should have said at first, she also reports, my kids were owning their learning. I could tell they were engaged, they were thinking, they were taking ownership of their learning. And it's sort of both of those that I want to see. I want to see the teacher's interaction is super valuable. But she herself valued having that data. She herself said, this affirms that training I took the time to do and all this work that I took the time to do in my in switching the way I taught, it really looks like it's paid off. I'm convinced it's paid off. Okay, so that's part of when we talk about all these issues around implementation of the Common Core, that's something to remember. This kind of data matters. Let me say some other things that are just happening. First of all, as you know, our assessments, end of year assessments are changing. So is the SAT in similar ways. The SAT is going to look like Smarter Balance, this evil test, because Smarter Balance is a better test than the SAT was. So these are the kinds of things that you may not have heard, but we are actually sort of trying to produce things that are more worthy of our students' attention is one of the main things we're trying to do. Another thing that's happening, let me sort of share a little bit, that we are trying to start for the first time a network of both teachers and higher educators working together across the state. California's had one for 30 years. Because of the needs at this moment and because of some of these successes, we're doing it here in Oregon for the first time. That's really exciting. That's what's important to me. As we sort of learn about some of these things, it's been interesting to sort of pay attention to the media and popular culture and realize we've heard more on the Common Core from Louis C.K. and Glenn Beck than we have the National Council for Teachers of Mathematics, the people whose jobs it is to set standards, et cetera. So there hasn't been a lot of time talking about what's in there. So I will stop there because it's been a pleasure to give you some idea of it.
It's a little bit nerve-wracking following Dev. I've worked with him before, and he gets going on math and look out. Fortunately, I have enough of a math background that I can hang with about half of what he's saying. My name is Matt Coleman. I do have four kids in the system, in the 4J system. I've got one at the high school level, two at the middle school level, and one at the elementary. So I've got one across all levels. I have been at Epic for the last year. Prior to that, I was the assistant superintendent in Springfield. Prior to being in Springfield, I was a large high school principal in the Beaverton School District in Beaverton, Oregon. I was a middle school principal in Beaverton, and I taught for a number of years in Beaverton and actually started teaching way back when in the Oakland Public Schools. And I bring up all of that just so you have some sense that what I'm going to talk about briefly in connecting with Dev's deep dive in terms of what the Common Core is how important it is in terms of the systems we employ to educate kids. There was an article in the Eugene Weekly several weeks ago, and it was around opt-out, and there was a statement made about if you really want to know how well your kids are doing, you go ask the teacher. I fundamentally agree with that at the elementary level. Having taught at the secondary level, having been an administrator at the secondary level, when you have loads of 150 to 180 kids that you see for anywhere from 45, depending on your schedule structure, 45 to 70 minutes every day, you do not have the luxury of getting to know your kids as an elementary teacher does. And that is one of what I would argue is the fatal flaw in our education system is the secondary school design. And I loved being a high school principal. I loved being a large comprehensive. The school I was at with 2,700 kids, I absolutely loved large comprehensive. But what we were constantly trying to do was to figure out how to create connections for kids and connections between what was happening classroom to classroom, both within a math scope and sequence and across from algebra class to algebra class and then from algebra class to geometry to algebra 2. The Common Core gives us, and especially in mathematics, and it gives us this concept of progressions of development across grade levels that we've not had before. And it is really, really critical within a high school, but then as critical between levels, between elementary to mid, mid to high. And it's that connectivity. And so, you know, I was as I read the person's, what they talked about in the Eugene Weekly, I found myself agreeing that yeah, there are elements of when I think about my own children, especially in the 4J system, where they've just had phenomenal teachers. At the elementary level, they were really known. I would tell you right now, and just because there aren't too many Colemans out there, I can't say exactly what I want to say because this is on the radio and I will be highlighting my own kids. I would tell you that what I've seen as a school administrator, what I see in my role right now, which is I'm working with schools and we're working at EPIC with schools in Hawaii and in Southern California, in the state of Washington, specifically Spokane, what we see is a secondary model that's highly impersonal. And just to illustrate that a little bit for you, my twins, we've got twins that are in sixth grade. When they were at Edgewood Elementary, again, phenomenal teachers, they would have the same teacher. And when you think in 1 week's time, the amount of individual contact in the same space with that one teacher, they become 11, right? So they go to sixth grade. They hit sixth grade. And the amount of time they had in 1 week, it takes 7 weeks to have, not just with the one teacher they have in middle school, but with the seven teachers. And so when I think about the Common Core specifically, and I think about having connections between levels and within, as kids get into the secondary system, it becomes really critical to know where they've been and know where they're going instructionally through a curriculum design like the Common Core. How many people saw, I mean, this threw me off this morning thinking I knew what I was going to talk about. Between seeing Ken Woody and then doing the duck push-up thing and trying to figure out what would Ken Woody write in his column in the Register Guard during football season. But then seeing today, how many people saw this morning? So I about literally flipped when I saw this. I was like, oh, great. Any big idea I had about what to talk about has just kind of gone out the window. I want to illustrate for you an argument that a very very intelligent, highly upward mobile in terms of her education, young student in Eugene is going. She, the student, when it was talking about opting out of Smarter Balanced, she actually, and I'm going to go ahead and read what she said, she builds a really, I think, elegant, compelling argument as to why she shouldn't take Smarter Balanced. And I underscore, she shouldn't take it. The 16-year-old also has to prepare for 6 upcoming tests. 2 for her advanced placement classes, 2 for the International Baccalaureate Program, and the ACT and the SAT college admission exams. We're losing upwards, this is her quote, we're losing upwards of 10 hours of class time, and that's just ridiculous. Standardized testing has gotten to the point where it's out of control and taking up so much of her time and resource. I know she knows this, but the AP exam and the IP exams, of which she'll be taking 4 in this month, are standardized assessments against a curriculum much like the Common Core that's been developed, that she is taking, and that if you use her quote coming after, she describes as ridiculous. They are actually 4 hours in length per. So what she is not opting in, and I don't disagree with her not taking Smarter Balance, don't get me wrong, actually she built a really great argument. But what she said she's going to use that time for is to actually prepare for these other, what I would argue are standardized large-scale tests that we kind of just hold for granted. So I actually think she builds a great argument for herself not to actually take it, because she's got all these other measures that you could point to that to say that she's gotten what she wants. And if you think about the ACT, part of why the SAT is changing, the ACT was designed against the classic college-going curriculum. When I was in Beaverton as a principal and then in Springfield, Springfield gives the ACT to every junior. And that's very purposeful, because we want to see curricularly and instructionally whether or not we are preparing kids, all kids, to go on to the next level. So we weren't going to see which kids chose to take it or afforded to take it or had the family kind of knowledge, college knowledge going forward of taking that test. She's building an argument that says, and again, I agree with her in saying no on the Smarter Balance for someone like her, but when she actually talks about these tests, these standardized tests being ridiculous, she actually uses that, and that's something that we just take for granted. Why this is important, I believe, from an accountability standpoint, and this is, I'll try to kind of close with this. We need schools, and we need measures of accountability, and they've historically kind of all been there. I would argue against using these kinds of tools, and I'm talking specifically Smarter Balance for teacher evaluation. My doctorate was in educational measurement, and I would argue, and I think I could build a very compelling and convincing argument that the use for that purpose is from a measurement standpoint, it's kind of malpractice. That's not what those tests were designed to do. From a school quality perspective, from a systems quality perspective, they're critical. Having that kind of information across all of your kids is critical to know where your school is going, that said, or where it's been, and whether or not it's improving, or whether it's delivering what it needs to deliver. With that said, the school quality piece needs more than a single measure. I know I'm going to get a question in a bit, but I'm going to preempt it a little bit around career. One of the big issues that we have in our current accountability system is that it's got this leaning towards college. And I've been in spaces, be it in Springfield, but I'm going to give you an example in a place I was 2 weeks ago in Hawaii, Waipahu High School, which butts up against Pearl Harbor. At Waipahu High School, they have an unbelievable aquaponics program. And in this aquaponics program, these kids, I mean, what they're doing with natural resources, and I mean, it's crazy. I guarantee on Smarter Balance, they're not going to get a prompt that allows them to know what and be able to show what they know. So what I'm not sitting up here saying from a Smarter Balance perspective is it's all about Smarter Balance. I am not an advocate necessarily of Smarter Balance. I am an advocate of having benchmarks against shared curricular outcomes, against something like the Common Core, so that specifically at the secondary level, we have an idea both in terms of instruction at the kid level, but course to course and year to year, whether or not we are getting kids to the place they need to be. Back to the young lady in her argument, she should not be spending time. It is ridiculous that she's going to be asked to take Smarter Balanced as well as these AP and IB exams, as well as ACT, in May of her junior year. I agree with her on that. But again, in her argument, it kind of illustrates the need for some level of, and I call it accountability, but some level of a systems check is what she's doing in AP and IB, and I would argue also with the ACT. So I'll leave it at that, and I think you are going to have a few questions for us.
So I'm Mary Layton. I'm a retired principal and with 45 years of experience in public schools. So my question actually emerges from a series of courses City Club co-sponsored with Lane ESD and Lane Workforce Partnership. We visited something like 25 companies for 3 hours over a period of a year and a half, and every place we went, the company said, whatever happened to shop class? Whatever happened to career training that was really hands-on? We know one Bulk Handling, which is a great company, has two Springfield graduates who did shop training in Springfield Public School. So So my question for you two, who are plainly keen to improve the quality of public education and have some sense of the policy environment, how can we get to do this again? This is a very important part, and the community believes in it. The community is very keen to see a better track from high school to jobs. And I just wonder if you had thoughts about how we can get there.
Well, first, the obvious is we need to invest more in our schools, but and invest more wisely. This sounds like a contradiction to folks, but having strong standards, especially ones which identify the need to apply, actually opens up these kinds of opportunities. I'll sort of quote from a teacher. She's great. We'll come back to a football reference. Her name is Fawn Nguyen. She grew up in Portland, but she's a huge Ducks fan who comes back to Autzen every fall. But and I got to meet her last winter. But she's doing some great creative things, like hanging Barbie from the ceiling and sort of taking measurements and trying to understand like how many rubber bands you need, and just very kind of hands-on and fun. And she's got some great engaged kids. The way she puts it is the Common Core is a list of ingredients. So the Common Core is a list of ingredients. I'm a chef. I'm a teacher. I'm a chef. I can make she's a really great chef, make really engaging, tasty kind of learning available to kids. But it's this list of ingredients. So the opportunity is now, because one of those ingredients is application, we're trying to tell math teachers is it's time to kind of reach out a bit to your science colleagues, and yes, your CTE colleagues, and yes, even your social science colleagues, because this is kind of the more authentic preparation, yes, for college and also for career. Whoever sort of works in one silo, who can walk into their boss's office, write 42, circle it, and leave, okay? That's not the way the world works, but that's the way we've been teaching. So for an example I like to give is think about hands-free devices and things like that. You can have kids calculate how far their car would travel when they send these messages. You can have them look up data on traffic accidents and under various things. And then you could be team teaching with a social studies teacher and say, okay, pretend you're presenting to the legislature. Let's see your report. Let's see your report with numbers and words. Let's get authentic. And so, of course, in CTE, it provides a lot of opportunity. So among our math network, statewide math network work, we're probably going to take work that the Oregon Department of Education math lead and CTE lead had done together and sort of do some next steps, and I'm looking at someone in the room who I want to help with those, with math lead for 4J, to sort of think about this kind of a math track, getting away from Algebra 1, Geometry, Algebra 2, which is kind of anachronistic, and really think about different tracks. I want the kids who are in those tracks to still have the option to go to Lane and without remediation take some coursework there. And so I want that CTE work, not always, not every single lesson, but to often reinforce the kind of number thinking, the kind of algebraic and functional reasoning that we know is going to prepare kids for college and career. There's other experts in the room who know better than I. People who want those really steady jobs, they need some amount of higher education. They need at least those certificates. That's what 40-40-20 is about. That's why it's an actual sort of, it's a fairly important goal. So I see CTE as critical. With a Common Core, though, I want to also see that CTE learning reinforcing these kinds of things, which will still keep some college options open, because that's critical for a lot of kids.
I would just adding to that and thinking more maybe from the macro policy perspective and thinking about accountability. If you look at the current way that we hold high school specifically accountable at the state level in terms of the state report card, South Eugene comes on top all the time. I was responsible for whatever secondary education in Springfield, and I'll tell you right now, I'd put Springfield High and Thurston High up against South Eugene any day of the week. And what's different is they are two different environments. And what happens is our fixation, and this word is going to sound like I'm talking out both sides of my mouth, but our fixation on large-scale summative assessments like OAKS, like Smarter Balance, to hold schools accountable have effectively narrowed the curriculum across the state for the last 20 years. And I would say this, it's something I was very proud of being a part of the Springfield schools. The Springfield as a community held a strong value that was embedded in the school system around professional technical education. And if the PTE, and this is, again, you don't see it on the statewide assessments, you don't see it on Smarter Balance, the critical thinking that's happening in that welding class, that's happening in the business that is about making cabinets and selling cabinets, that is happening in the business department, in these fully articulated CTE programs that all live at Springfield High and Thurston, that feed programming at LCC but don't rely on LCC to kind of take that on, as maybe other districts who might be represented in the room have over time. If Springfield got credit for that from a school accountability perspective, their scores and their ratings would be higher. And so while I am a proud South Eugene parent, and I'm not suggesting that South Eugene is any less, I am suggesting that from a large-scale accountability perspective, Springfield and Thurston and a lot of other schools in Oregon have been promoted and thus perceived as less because of a fixation on a very limited set of standards, even with the Common Core, a very limited set of standards that when we collectively think about what we want our kids coming out from the education system, we look for more than that. And that is very, I think, has been very, very, very problematic. I do think it's actually going to shift. I think there's going to be an accountability. We're going to move away from fixation on the right measure, and we're going to look at the accountability structure in this country over the next 3 or 4 years, trying to read the tea leaves a little bit at the federal and the state's levels and with what's happening in California, to where I actually think we're going to see programming in those areas incented in terms of having them, because that schools that and communities that value them and that maintain them and feed them are actually going to get credit for that, which I think is critically, critically important. And I think it's going to happen.
Thank you. Today's topic is how the Common Core helps achieve our goals for public education with speakers Matt Coleman and Dev Sinha. We'll break for a few minutes now to formulate audience questions. Thanks, everybody.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, KMPQ Roseburg. We're on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet. This is KLCC, NPR for Oregonians.
Welcome back to the April 24th City Club program, How the Common Core Helps Achieve Our Goals for Public Education. Our speakers today are Matt Coleman and Dev Sinha. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each. Thank you.
I'm John Anik, City Club member since 2003. For over 30 years, I taught social studies in various places in Illinois and in Palo Alto. One of the things I did was proctor examinations, both College Board and the California State Standard Requirements, which we gave every spring. One of the things I noticed is the different approach the test takers took. Obviously, the College Board students were well motivated because their scores determined what school they would be attending and perhaps what kind of scholarship aid they were going to receive. But on the standardized tests, where everybody enrolled was taking the exams, there were always students who just sat around and did nothing until I prodded them to do something. And even when then, you had some of it, because these are standardized tests, just filled in squares wherever they felt like it. Geographic patterns, five in a row, yes, five in a row, no, that kind of thing. They didn't care. And the question is, in measuring school results on the Common Core, this has become a measurement device for quality. But how do you motivate students to do well on these tests? What are the payoffs for students to perform to the best of their ability on standardized tests that measure Common Core results?
If you and we can answer that, we're going to make a lot of money. And just so you know, there's actually a technical term. We call those mischievous, and this is actually a really, truly is a technical term in the measurement field. They're mischievous responders. And I've got to admit that I was a mischievous responder back in 1986 when, and this is part of the funny thing around this accountability movement is we act as if it just started. I remember 1986 as a junior at Bedales High School. I believe it was the Iowa Test of Basic Skills. I don't remember. But it was the first year that the juniors actually had to take it. And we were going to have to take it again in the senior year. And so our protest was to do exactly what you just articulated. And I did get in trouble at home, as did most of my classmates, all 188 of us, because we did exactly that. And I will say this. I don't know that there's an easy answer outside of trying to get kids, give kids an understanding that it actually really is an opportunity to gather important information. The challenge is, and again, I've stated this a couple of times, is that when it's kind of that single measure that from a school quality perspective, literally about 75% of an elementary school's report card is dependent on those scores and the growth you see between, that's when it becomes problematic because it's kind of that only measure. And so my hope is as you have mischievous responders is that you're actually able to almost discount that, but you've got other measures, you've got other ways of looking at who they are and how they're progressing that you're paying attention to. I will say this, my daughter took Smarter Balance this week, sixth grade, and one of the things that they are doing with technology is the prompts were more interesting. She didn't say she had fun. But when I asked her, and knowing we were going to be talking today, when I asked her about it, she actually indicated that it was more, it was better than the Oaks, in part because there was more back and forth with her. It was more engaging, the actual assessment. It wasn't just your sit-down paper and pencil. So that was a positive.
Let me add one thing that's concrete along those lines. This is fairly recent news. Oregon joined a list of states which is saying if you do well enough on Smarter Balance 11th grade, you automatically get to start taking college credit-bearing coursework when you show up at an Oregon public institution of higher education. So it's one of those things that we're trying to fix a problem that people aren't aware of. People aren't aware that 75% of kids show up at Lane and have to take this remedial work. Some people are aware and they're working hard of it, but this is a large problem that's not very well known. So whether that will motivate kids, I mean, again, they're 11th graders, but you're at least, it's there for the few who say, oh, wait, you know, this actually can make a difference. My family can't pay an extra year's worth of tuition. I better try on this. And then sort of along those lines at the rest of the grades, this is giving more accurate information. Our previous assessments, we now know that 75% who aren't making it at Lane, that does not match up with the ones who were succeeding on Oaks before. So for some, it's, yes, this is a more, it's not going to be perfect, but it's a better piece of information. And for others, there is that remediation piece, which is now Oregon policy.
Greetings, I'm Paul Thompson, a City Club member for some number of years. In preparation for today's presentation, I did go, by the way, and take a little bit of the sample exam of the Smarter Balance math test, and I sixth grade, and I emerged with a feeling that if the students could pass that, I would be ecstatic. And I was very favorably impressed with the math part of it. However, turning our attention to the language arts part for a second, which has been a lot more controversial and which is more subjective in its grading, I wonder if you would make comments about the efficacy of that particular test, the wisdom that people have in opting out of that because the kids are going to fail, because for some reason at various grade levels, the text which has been selected is not appropriate to that grade level. So it's a test construct problem. So there's a whole problem that surrounds the language arts part which may not apply to the math part.
I have to stay clear. I know people have been working on it, and maybe we can work. And I could even maybe put you in touch with some of them if you're interested in the basic shift of the Common Core. I think is highly valid and relevant. Namely, less what do you think about this, and more what can you provide evidence for about this. And again, there's an interesting equity piece to that too, because if you know, this is about where did you go for summer vacation, and you're a kid whose family can't afford to go on summer vacation, that's different. Or what in your experience resonates with this character's, you know, adventure, and again, your experience isn't there. So I know that the Common Core is supposed to really focus back on close reading and things like that, but I cannot talk about the validity of the constructs on the assessment itself.
I would attempt to, but kind of really by just saying that we're not going to know the efficacy. And as you go into Smarter Balance, or if you go to the park assessment, it's going to be years before we know whether or not, and specifically as you're articulating in an area that's more subjective, it's going to be a little, I think it's going to be tighter in math, and I think we'll get to a level of efficacy in math before literacy. And, you know, and I don't care how much money, you know, has been thrown at it, it's about $350 million. There's a development cycle that just takes time to know if what you think you're measuring is actually being measured. And that's going to happen over time.
Let me mention, for example, because I've been privy to some of this work. On the math side, they develop items. They then have students do it and talk about what they're thinking. And then the item developers can see, okay, are the students engaging in this activity like we think? But that's expensive, but that's one reason it's good to do it as part of a lot of states. That's why it doesn't really make sense for Oregon to kind of go it alone. We're going to get a very sort of cheap assessment and kind of get what we pay for. But that kind of work, it does take a while for...
I'm Marjorie Ramey and been a City Club member for a number of years, as you may guess. Our table was interested in the training for teachers, let's say particularly in high school. What sort of training is available or required for teachers to handle these new thoughts and the new performances? Can you answer that for us?
Not enough. And yeah. And when I say not enough, I'm going to say for what came before, there was not enough. And when people start to compare us internationally, I'm talking about the U.S. system internationally, one of the things that becomes very apparent is in other systems that are, depending on what measures you're using, are outperforming the U.S., we do not invest enough in the development of professional capital. Not just classic professional development, but how are you putting teachers together, and how are they working together, how are they learning together, and how is their efforts driving programming? We had a group from China in Springfield about 2.5 years ago, and they, about the teachers that were there, math teachers, about fell out of their chair when they learned of how we define teaching. We in this country define teaching as how much time you're engaging directly in front of your kids or with your kids. They define teaching to include collaborating with other professionals that are teaching the same content, to providing feedback to kids directly, so not with kids, but producing the feedback. All of that was captured as teaching. In this country and other high-performing countries that are outperforming us on different international measures, that is really one of the consistent differences we see, is that we in this country do not invest in professional capital, both at the individual teacher level, but then also the social capital between teachers that share kids, and especially at the secondary and the high school level. So when I say not enough, I mean it's a significant barrier for not only the work today, but the work 35 years ago when we basically had the same cohort grad rates that we kind of have today. I mean, we've not seen much growth because I don't think we're paying attention to what some call the right levers for change, including investing in what you just articulated.
And then to give another comparison, so we happen to have in the room one person whose professional duties include sort of thinking about that training for math, and another person who volunteers a lot to help her out. But by way of contrast, Berkeley, California, with a, I think it's a medium-sized school district, I'd say, a single high school, if I'm not mistaken. They have a K-5 math specialist, a middle school math specialist, and a high school math specialist, all for that medium-sized school district. 3 years ago in Lane County, we had one math specialist in the county. That was Maddie's predecessor. Now it's a little bit better. In addition to Maddie, there's some TOSAs who are sort of gotten up the curve, but it's still, we have a resource issue in Oregon, and this is an area that schools have rightly cut back on.
Okay, Linda Hamilton with Blackson Government, member of City Club. And gentlemen at our table, I wanted to ask the question, how do you explain that U.S. students rank 27th in the world behind European unions and other students from schools that do vastly less testing?
Well, I mean, the behind doesn't really resonate a lot with me, because when you break those numbers out by socioeconomic, we're not doing so badly, but we're not necessarily doing so great either. The thing that really motivates me is again, the kids who get to Lane, who get to UO, who don't have the skills they need. I wouldn't blame testing, or I wouldn't sort of say testing is going to save us either. It's a useful thing, especially if you're trying to decide, okay, we just spent a lot of money on a curriculum. Was that a good investment or not? We just spent a lot of money on teacher training, hearing about how great that works in China. Is that a good investment or not? At the large scale, about half of the academic field of math education, for example, and other parts of education, use that kind of data. So do other folks around the world. It's a part of the story, but it's not. Testing isn't going to save us. It's not sinking us either. It's something that's useful, but limited useful.
I just double down, and really what I just talked about in terms of professional capital and that investment in professional capital, a lot of those countries invest very differently and think differently about how professional development and the social capital, how teachers interact on a daily basis. They actually build that into their instructional models. And again, there's a resource piece to that, but there's also for the collective us in the room redefining what we think of when we think of teaching and learning. Because most of us, when we think of teaching and learning, we think about the FaceTime I have with the instructor and not recognizing all of this other stuff that goes in the background.
I'm Laura Illig. I've been a City Club member since 2012. And our table wanted to ask you a little bit about, there's been so much misinformation and lack of communication about the Common Core, about Smarter Balance and other tests. And there's a lot of fear out there. So there's fear from parents, there's fear from the larger community. How do we do a better job of communicating the benefits of Common Core and the testing in the ways that you just articulated, and at the same time, help parents feel more competent to support their kids in going through this process of potentially new homework, new ways of thinking, new models?
Basically, if you think about, again, we're stuffing 30 first graders in a classroom. We're stuffing 45 middle schoolers in a classroom. The districts would love to have the capacity to reach out to parents. A lot of individual teachers, heroes that they are doing some really nice job because they sort of recognize that need. Other teachers are not, and you can't blame them for it. There's a lot on their plate. There are some pretty good resources out there. I wrote one that's now being used in Southern California, New Jersey, Chicago, Louisiana, various places that is kind of an introduction. But we certainly need more. First things first, we want to make sure the teachers understand what's going on. And then we'll hopefully get to the parents and general public. But those of us who are kind of working on this are really focused on things like providing the support to teachers and have less time for some of this kind of advocacy you see.
I would. Part of where I was like, just like, oh my God, I'm thinking about my own kid, and I'm not going to tell you what age, because again, if anybody, his or her friends aren't listening, but I'm assuming. But I was going through, I mean, I've been in public schools for 21 years. I mean, now in the role that I'm in, and I visited a ton of high schools this year, I've probably been in 25, 30 different high schools. And I was a teacher, I was an administrator. I mean, I think I know a little bit about public education, specifically secondary education. And I don't know what the heck I'm doing with my middle school, with my kids. I got three kids in secondary. I mean, it's crazy because I should know. And I think it speaks to the complexity of education as a profession, as an endeavor. And I think the collective tries to simplify it because we've all been there, done that. And I think that's been very dangerous for us in this country. But at the same time, we do it to ourselves in education that we make everything infinitely complex. There's nothing that's simple. And I'll give you a good example. It's part of what my answer would be we've got to figure out how to simplify so parents know when to ask and when to expect a response. And I'll give you an example. When my twins were in the NICU, they were born at 28 weeks, they're in the neo-intensive care unit. We had a whole protocol and process as they were looking to get on the normal growth curve by the time they were 2 years old. So they were born, you know, essentially 3 months premature. When we go in and work with the occupational therapist who's working with our, you know, 9-month-olds, they do some crazy assessment. I had no idea what they're doing. I had no idea what they were looking for. But what I knew is if the X from the assessment was below the preemie growth curve, I knew to expect them to say, you know what, we're going to double the occupational therapy that your child's getting. And the 45 minutes you're spending at a kind of structured play that was part of the process, we're going to double that too. So your 45 minutes after dinner is now going to be an hour and a half. I knew to expect it. I had no idea what they were measuring. But I knew to expect a response from them and that they were going to expect me to do something different. We are trying to work on something like this, and specifically we've done it in Springfield. And the staff, Epic's got about 50 staff, and they literally right now are working with sixth graders at Hamlin Middle School. And we've taken the multiple kind of measures, that, including their report card, what's called report card conferencing, and we actually created a visual that allowed the parent's not in the room. Big idea is that kids are going to tell caring adults who they don't know more than they tell their parents. That's probably a bad assumption, but we find it to be true with kids this age. That if it's, they do this actually, this cool graph, but if anything gets colored red, it tells the kid, it tells the parent, and it tells the school, we've all got to do something different. And I would love to see us try to simplify some things that I think as educators, as a profession, we continue to keep complex, or we communicate in really ineffective ways that allow people to know when action is required. And especially at the high school level, thinking in terms of action at the kid level, action at the school level, and action at the family level. But as somebody who's been in it for 21 years, got to help me with my own 16-year-old. Sorry, Griff.
And let me sort of add, because I do know that there's math frustration out there. So first of all, don't spend a lot of time on something that doesn't make sense to you or your kid. Don't let it be a torturing thing. Just say, okay, I can't do it. Let's hopefully your teacher will clarify it up the next day. Secondly, so I mentioned understand and apply. See what your kid can explain to you. Again, if you're both confused, say, all right, well, we don't understand this. Can you tell me about something related that you can understand, that you do understand? What have you been drawing pictures for that? Have you, you know, that process alone, that's often arguably more valuable than the homework itself. So just have them explain what they know. Again, with our resources these days, they don't get enough of that in classrooms. The exemplar videos that I know of, the classrooms that I've went to around the country, you're looking at classroom sizes of 15 to 20. So if as a parent you can be having some conversations with them, that's good, and that's probably an even bigger priority around these parts. And finally, yeah, the apply piece, bring it up in your, think about things like in your life, like saving up for something, saving up for college if you've got a high school student. You reinforce two different things there. And there, if you really think about interest in everything and loans and how long will it take to pay off, there's a lot of really good math there of the kind that they need reinforced to be ready for college.
Stephanie Harger, City Club member. I agree that there are a lot of good ideas that come out of this type of teaching, certainly in the approach. But to look at the financial aspect for a minute, we keep talking about, yes, we need to keep reinvesting in our schools, and we all know how much money our schools need. So I just, in relationship to the financial cost of this program, the statistic I was able to pull up says that states will spend an estimated $10 billion up front, then as much as $800 million per year for the first 7 years of this program. I am curious if that is, I would imagine it's at least approximately correct, why we would maybe spend the money on that versus how many more teachers could that pay, how many more programs could we implement? And could you speak very, very quickly, I suppose, to that?
And I would throw out a piece. I love the stats. I'm assuming they're correct because I don't know them, but I appreciate you bringing those up. I would say this, and I've had this argument with or discussion with Tony Alpert, who's the chief operating officer for Smarter Balanced, who started it in Oregon in the Department of Ed. I was more interested in having balanced smarter, not smarter balanced. The Smarter Balance, it's computer adaptive. It's what the kids are taking right now at South Eugene, what the kids are talking about in the paper today. The state of Oregon, roughly, it's about $26, $27 per kid per year, somewhere in there. The balance part costs about $5. And the balance part is the part that teachers then would need to be trained and work, and they work it into the curriculum. Sometimes we call it through assessment or through testing. It's through the curriculum. I would love to see our state take the lead in flipping the fact that we're less interested in $27 per kid and smarter, and let's go with the huge potential with the balanced, and the balanced is only five. Now, there are costs in there, and the cost in there is having the teacher administer it, having be part of the curriculum and have the teacher assess it. I think teachers would get more excited about it because the what's been developed is really quite cool, and I think kids are engaged, and teachers love that kind of stuff, and they are assessing all the time. But I don't want to pretend like there's that $800 million. There's still a cost to that because, you know, the teacher is administering it. But I think you then could reposition what you do with the $27 per kid. So I'd love to see balance smarter.
So two words on that. First of all, we are the only state to not purchase the balance as a state. Out of the whole consortium, we're the only ones to say, not so sure about the other during this, the year tools. The other thing is, this is a great Common Core problem. $600 million sounds like a lot, or $800 million. Our budget for education is two-thirds of a trillion, over $600 billion. So there are things like time and, again, energy and classroom attention diverted, but as a monetary thing, I do not see the cost as an issue.
Thank you, Matt Coleman and Dev Singhop, for bringing clarity and vision to this City Club program, how the Common Core helps achieve our goals for public education. Thanks again to our sponsors, Pacific University, Hearing Associates, and KRVM. We meet again on May 1st at the Downtown Athletic Club for Civic Education in Oregon, Youth Voices, with a panel from Willamette, Thurston, Sheldon, and South Eugene High Schools, as well as youth representatives from LULAC and Teen Court. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thank you.